everybody, this is Brian Dunaway, and you're listening to Comics Coast to Coast. This is episode number 32. And I have in the Skype studio with me today, I have Justin Thompson from Myth Tickle. Justin?
Hiya, Brian.
How you doing?
Welcome back to the show. You've been gone for 2 weeks.
I know. Yeah, I bet you did miss me. I really do. But you guys did a great job while I was gone. I can't say enough about it.
Thanks, Love Dart.
And we got Tom Racine with us also. Tom Racine, how you doing?
We missed you, Brian. We missed you terribly, man.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, he was.
Yeah,
he was doing some pretty good editing over there without me. So I guess I'm really.
Right.
I guess I'm not really even needed. So
right. Look up the definition of third wheel, and there you are, baby.
And tonight on the show number 32, I'm going to let Justin introduce our guest tonight, who's already on the line and waiting patiently to be introduced. So go ahead.
All right, listeners. Today's guest has been honored by the National Cartoonist Society 4 times, both as a strip cartoonist and as a panel cartoonist, and also won a Reuben in his very first year of syndication, the only comic strip to ever achieve that. In the late 70s, he worked here where I am right now, broadcasting here in Santa Rosa. He worked at the Press Democrat in Santa Rosa, California. And in 1985, he was hired as an editorial cartoonist in the San Francisco Examiner. His first strip, Fenton, ran for 3 years. And eventually, in 1991, he launched his popular strip, Non Sequitur, eventually syndicated to 700 newspapers. He has 8 books out now as both collections of his strip and as children's books. And the new children's book debuts next week on February 1st. It's called Attack of the Volcano Monkeys. Mm. Wiley Miller, we are ecstatic to have you with us on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're easily excited.
It's true.
I've heard that. Wiley, I want to ask you right off the bat, when was the last time you were here in Santa Rosa?
Oh, gosh, that had to be, 2002, I think, from when they had the National Cartoon Society had their Reuben Awards in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, so is that year, whatever year that was.
Well, it's well, you should come
years.
Out again.
That was the first time in a very long time, so.
And you vow to never return.
they won't let me return.
It's 6 years. You got to get back out of here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to the real important thing. Oh, okay. Well, let's get to the important thing. You got a new book coming out. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's my second children's book, second in the series of The Ordinary Basil. This is. Picks up where the first book left off. The first book is The Extraordinary Adventures of Ordinary Basil. And this is the Ordinary Basil, the Island of the Volcano Monkeys, or Attack of the Volcano Monkeys, a couple of times. And this second book was done entirely for the book form. The first book was adapting from the series I did in the Sunday editions of the strip.
Yeah.
Back in 2005, that was the first time Basil appeared, and was real hit with the readers, and Scholastic got a hold of it and ended up doing a 2-book deal with them.
Nice.
So the second book was a much more complicated story, and because I did it strictly for the book, I got to do a lot more elaborate art than what I'm able to do in the small confines of comic strip. And so just recently I finished up in the Sunday series a third storyline of Ordinary Basil. So the stories that appeared this year of Basil is actually a sequel to the book that's coming out.
Excellent. I'm excited. I can't wait to see
enough.
It. Yeah. Now, have you tested this children's book out on any children?
Not this one, but the first one was quite successful. It got a lot of great reviews.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and this one is even more exciting.
Yeah.
I've got a lot more adventure to it.
Sweet. Now, do you have a lot of kids in your life that you can bounce these off of, or are you just?
No. This all comes from my little tiny mind, and I just kind of do stories that would have appealed to me when I was a kid.
Excellent.
I never try in any of my work. I never think of an audience. You know, I think a writer has to write for themselves and to entertain themselves. Cause
that's right.
Once you start, you're focusing too much and pandering to a certain demographic or a focus group type thing. You just lose your creativity. You start writing for what you think they want to hear instead of what makes you interested. And I think that if you're not really interested in what you're doing, then how can you expect anybody else to be?
Absolutely. Plus, kids suck the life out of you.
But our kids are grown and don't have any grandkids.
But Wiley, are you planning on, or do you foresee these?
Go ahead.
Skype lag. Do you foresee these as animated features anytime? Or I mean, do you ever play that idea or having that in the works?
Actually, no. You know, I envision it more as live action because that's kind of how it plays out in my head.
Yeah.
Because it's more of an adventure story. The thing that scares me about animation is I call it the slide whistle technique.
Okay.
Where there's this natural tendency to get too goofy with animation and doing really ridiculous and plausible things. The whole aspect of what I've done in the Basil stories is that with them being fantastic stories and fantastic settings and so forth, I really tried to make it plausible that there's no magic in these stories. Nothing magical happens. You may wave a magic wand and Goofy gets to be somewhere, time travel or anything like that. Everything, the laws of physics apply to my story.
Yeah.
And I think that just makes it easier for the readers, especially for kids, to identify with. Because, like I said, even though it's fantastic, it's something that is quasi-believable, that you can place yourself into that and see maybe that you could be in that position where you can never see yourself as, being in the position of a wizard.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe. Nice, but yeah, that's great. I'd love to see a live action. That's a totally different direction than most are going in. So that would be very interesting to see. Now, do you have anybody cast in your mind who could play these parts?
No. because the thing is that if there was a movie deal made today, that the movie wouldn't come out for a few years.
Yeah, 2012, 2013, maybe.
Right. So if you think of some of your kids, anybody you've seen today, that they'd be too old.
Yeah, like Macaulay Culkin.
Get back to production. Yeah. So that's why I don't even think about that.
Yeah.
Because the kid might not be born yet who would play the part if we get that far.
That sounds awesome.
We are talking. There are have it optioned right now and taking it to studios and. And they're mostly, seem to be more interested in the animation.
They do.
Aspect of it. So, I'm waiting to hear, what they have to say and how it would be done. So, if it was done in animation, I'd really want it to be, very realistic and stay true to the story and not get too, Saturday morning cartoonish about it.
Yeah.
Would you be interested in that in sort of a motion capture thing that they're doing now?
That's exactly what I'm thinking. That's what I talked to them about. I said, if it does go animation, I want to do the go that route because that's the
technology. I know they're doing
and bring the believability to it.
I know they're doing Tintin. Peter Jackson, Steven Spielberg are doing motion captured Tintin. So it'd be interesting to see. I haven't seen anything from that yet, so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. I want to know, I mean, nobody in their right mind wouldn't want to make a movie called Attack of the Volcano Monkeys. I mean, come on, it's one of the greatest titles of all time.
It is a great title.
Thank you.
I was going to ask, you live in Maine now?
Yes, live in Maine.
Yeah.
Kennebunkport.
And you're from California? That's a heck of a change, because I love Maine. I used to live in New York. We used to get up to Maine all the time. Was you were just drawn by the bush aura? Pulled you up there?
Now you know. Yeah, my wife and I have been coming here for many years. My wife is originally from New England. Her sister, one of her sisters and her husband had a house up here, vacation home for many years. And so we've been coming to visit them several times. And we just fell in love with Maine. And so we even said, well, let's move there. Because, we're back in California and we're in Santa Barbara. And we just, as wonderful and nice as that is, we just felt too crowded.
Yeah,
too many people in California. And we like, especially the older we get, the more peace and quiet you want.
I knew it. Quiet, you kids! Quiet!
Yeah, get off my lawn.
That is awesome.
Well, yeah, I want to talk about non sequitur right now. And there's something, ever since I started reading this strip, I've noticed something. And I've always wanted to ask you this, and I'm finally getting the opportunity. Excluding your Sunday Basil strips and the Lucy and Danae strips, the other strips that you throw in there, very often show an omnipotent kind of camera angle, like a wide shot with slightly above where we're looking down on the action. Mm-hmm. Why does that view appeal to you so much?
To my God complex. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to say, but
when I started the strip that I did single panel cartoons in the comic strip format.
Yeah.
This was something I figured out many years ago, back when I was doing my first comic strip and just wanted to do a panel. And even way back then, we were talking about the early 80s.
Oh man.
That's the people in the syndicate about doing a panel, and they tell me, they said all of them would say, just panels don't sell. So it hurt. Well, what about this thing called the Far Side? They said, well, that was the anomaly.
Yeah.
But they just found it just impossible to sell panels anymore. And that just struck me very odd.
Yeah.
Because, a panel doesn't have to be locked down on a comics page. You can float anywhere in the paper.
Yeah.
Well, things have just only gotten worse in the comics and trying to sell anything new. So that when I was coming on to developing this feature, I decided that I would do the single panel, but do it in the comic strip dimension.
Yeah.
So it'd be easier to sell and could lock down. Well, with this wide panorama, that doing a graphically, doing a standard cartoon at the usual eye level, didn't work for that dimension.
Yeah.
So I realized that by pulling that camera angle either up or down, using perspective, that it utilized, it kind of filled out this panorama in a natural manner rather than just trying to draw lines up there or to draw a box around it.
Yeah.
So if you notice, the whole concept of non-sequitur I took on as a design challenge, because for so many decades, cartoonists have been whining and complaining about how small comics are run. Well, having worked in newspapers as long as I have, I pretty much figured out that editors aren't going to change, and they're not going to do things that are better for cartoonists.
Yeah.
So comics are not going to get any bigger. They're only going to get smaller. Editors are not going to help us out in that area. They just don't care. So instead of continuing to whine and complain about this, that I think it's incumbent on us to to deal with the space that we have and to maximize it and use the best we can. So that's how I set out in designing my cartoons, and a lot of that has to do with perspective. So you'll notice that even on my on the cartoon that I don't have a border on the cartoon, on the single panels, that I use the art itself. I use white space and I use the art itself to fill out that space. So especially in the beginning, a lot of people were asking me, you know, how come my cartoon was printed larger than the other strips on the page? And I said, it's not. It's the same size. It's just an optical illusion.
Yeah.
It's utilizing that space and maximizing it.
Smart man. That's why you've been so successful. Amazing. Yeah, I know.
You're like the Cecil B. DeMille of the comics artists. So.
Well, I'd like to see it. Well, you know, it's actually, I'm really not that smart. but what
we are cartoonists.
You're right, but I am a cartoonist.
Yeah.
The thing that bothers me about so many cartoons is that, you know, that we tend to get lazy and we you know, expect things to get done for us. We just kind of follow along and do what the suits tell us to do. And we have to take care of our own business. I mean, this is, you know, our business. Nobody's going to really help us with it.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, the more you educate yourself about the industry that you're in and the production and the format and how you can possibly make things better for yourself instead of just following along with what has already been done and what has always been done and nobody ever asked why.
Yeah.
That really bothers me.
I agree.
That cartoonists just don't sit there and ask questions. They just do what they're told. And I said, no, there are alternatives. You just have to work a little harder and figure it out. And, you know, that led me to, you know, so many different things that I could do with the strip, including, you know, making it into both a strip and panel.
That's great. I was going to say, one of my all-time favorite things about Non Sequitur is that it's almost like every time they tell you you can't do something, you go do it. It's sort of like, well, you can't have a panel in a strip. Oh, yes, I can. You can't have characters on the panel. Yes, you can. You know.
Yeah. So that's the obstinate side of me.
Yeah. Yeah.
which was what made me an editorial cartoonist. But yeah. Yeah. Tell me I can't do something. I'll show you. Yes, it can be done. I'll show you how. But so that was especially true with the Sunday Color.
Yeah.
The format on that introduced this process color. And simply because I had worked in newspapers for so long and had worked as a staff artist and had worked, you know, using process color for the art in newspapers, you know, going back into the mid-70s. And it always bothered me that, you know, it used to be that the only color you ever saw in a newspaper was the Sunday Comics.
Yeah.
Well, gradually it turned to be that the worst color you saw in the newspaper was in the Sunday Comics. everything else had surpassed because, you know, the Sunday Comics were still using the antiquated, you know, flat spot color.
You're right.
It just looked awful. And so just one day I, you know, talking with Tim Rosenthal, who was the production manager at American Color, and just offhandedly I said, yeah, by the way, you know, how come we don't have process color for the comics? Because I just hated doing the color for my Sundays, because it was just so boring. You have this color chart, and you do an overlay, and you write in the number according.
Yeah,
it was just so mechanical and so anti-art. Oh, yeah, it drove me crazy. So I just asked him, why can't we have process color like they do with the rest of the newspaper? And Tim said, oh, I didn't have process color. This is something you don't want to pay for it.
Oh.
I said, what? Wait, okay, let's talk about this.
Nice.
And so, long story short, it was, I figured out how to do the process color without it being more expensive.
Yeah.
And it was simply because I asked why.
Yeah.
I said, why hasn't anybody done this before? And Tim said, nobody ever asked.
So you finally got out of creating paint-by-number cartoons for Sundays, and got into actually coloring. So that's great.
Yeah. So,
love that.
So with the big help of Tim Rosenthal,
yeah.
The late Tim Rosenthal, he's a great guy, we set out to change the landscape there. And we both met the same resistance from the syndicate and
yeah.
from American Colors. They said, oh, it can't be done. We can't do this. And we said, bullshit. Sure, it can be done. And we did it. And so we just pulled ahead, and that just broke down all the barriers. Now that opened the door so everybody to use the computer art and all
yeah.
that. All changed. So that we could finally have more individual style of coloring.
That's awesome. I did not know you
were
such a go-getter.
So what you're saying with the perspective and you're pioneering this process color thing, that with most cartoonists, it's not so much being smart, it's just being successfully experimental. You know, and I guess by nature and by what we do, cartoonists, we think inside the box quite literally.
Mm.
And that maybe yeah. looking at our strips so much, you know, somehow in our subconscious, it limits us from trying to stretch and break boundaries, I guess. I don't know, but...
Yeah, because, I can tell you from experience that, you know, especially when you first break in, you know, get your first strip syndicated, and the syndicate, you know, then goes about telling you how it's done. So, you know, okay, here's the format, and here's what you have to do, and, you know, this is where it fits in, blah, blah, blah. You give you all these, the structure. And you just go along with it because, you know, first of all, you're usually, you know, quite young.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just want to get your cartoons out there, and you just
right.
go along with it. And so then you end up, you know, just getting accustomed to that, and you just don't change. And you just never question. And also because you get so overwhelmed with trying to meet your deadlines that, you know, you don't think about it.
But, yeah.
This is the advantage I had was having worked in newspapers for so long and that I knew more about the process, about the printing process,
mm-hmm.
and how newspapers put out, and working in graphic design, who hasn't worked as an illustrator. You know, my career as a staff artist was, I was always the staff art department.
You know? I hear that, yeah.
Yeah, everywhere I worked as a staff artist, that's the way it was. Every time I left, they had to replace me with two or three people. So because of that, yeah, that's stuff you can do when you're young. I'm
yeah.
too old. I have that kind of energy now, but that kind of, that background, you know, allowed me to, you know, think outside the box because I had to do so many different things. You know, so many different types of illustration, you know, from very hard graphics, you know, graphs and charts and all that, to
yeah.
very loose cartoony stuff, and having to work with so many different editors and, you know, putting this out, and of course learning all the color processing and so forth. So I had a good base of knowledge to go
yeah.
on, so that I had something to say why or why not.
Yeah, so you were like the perfect storm, just waiting to happen.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And a lot of people hate me.
We haven't talked to anybody on the show yet who's a political cartoonist. How did you get started political cartooning, and do you still do that? I know you still work at Into Non Sequitur, but do you still do political cartooning?
Local cartooning?
Political cartooning. How did you get started in that?
Oh, political cartooning.
And
right.
Do you still do that?
I miss. I'll tell you what I miss is the atmosphere of a newsroom.
Mm, yeah.
There's a macabre sense of humor that can
yeah.
permeate a newsroom that would, you know, outside of a newsroom would all seem in very bad taste to.
Yeah.
Normal human beings, but there's a certain energy there, especially when, you know, something big happens, and so there's a real vibe that you can't capture anywhere else. So
yeah.
that aspect I miss. And the aspect I really miss about editorial cartooning is that most of the work is done for you.
Yeah.
And there's no shortage of idiots out there doing incredibly moronic things, and the crap that spills out of their mouth and on the TVs is just astounding. And so today, it would be so kind of pretty much phoning your work in.
Yeah. Especially right now, with everybody running for president.
I mean, there's just such an abundance of material to play with and have fun with. And what's really so pathetic to me is just what has become of the art form over the years. And it's not, and I don't blame cartoonists entirely for this, only somewhat. It's just how they're missing the boat on, editorializing.
So
much gag-oriented work. And I think what's made it worse is now the advent of the cartoonist animating their stuff.
And then,
getting back to the animation tends to go more towards the entertainment value. Let's have Hillary doing silly things, dancing around and all that. won't that be funny? It's funny, but what's the point?
Yeah. Let's have Bill fall asleep during the middle of a Martin Luther King.
It's cute and funny, but what's the point?
And
that this is what is so sadly missing in editorial cartoons today, so many of them.
Yeah.
That there is no point to them. It's just to make a joke or to get out there. But again, that's not entirely the fault of the cartoonist.
Yeah.
This is what editors want.
This is true.
They don't want you editorializing anymore.
Yeah.
So the most effective editorial cartoonists, the ones who really editorialize the most, who I think doing the best work, is Pat Oliphant and Ann Pelmes.
Yeah.
And what do they have in common? They don't work for a newspaper. They're both just syndicated. And so they have that freedom of just saying exactly what they want and not being reined in by some idiotic editor who's afraid the phone's going to ring.
Do you think that these political cartoonists are shooting themselves in the foot by syndicating? What do you think about...
That's the bane of the... let me clarify that, of staff editorial cartoonists.
Yeah.
I think editorial cartoonists should do one, if you want to be syndicated, then by all means, go and syndicate your work like Pat Oliphant does and like Ann Pelmes does.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to work for a newspaper, then you should be working exclusively for that newspaper. It's the syndication of staff editorial cartoons that has absolutely killed this art form.
Yeah.
This is why we have all these cartoonists out of work today, because all the bean counters are in. Say, well, what can we get rid of? Well, what about the cartoonists? Yeah. Why should we be paying salary and benefits to one guy when we can run 50 cartoons for less?
That's a good point.
And we don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
So you put yourself in their shoes when they're doing budget crunches.
Yeah.
What would you do? You'd do the same damn thing.
Yeah.
They're just looking to fill that space, and they're going to do it as cheaply as possible.
And I think that's hurting newspapers, too. That's one of the things they're not focused on. They're so worried about... being
the global, bottom line,
and being global and not necessarily being local. And that's where they're going to have to, because the internet's already taking care of the global. You're going to have to get more local.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I agree.
So you're
good, Justin.
No, I'm sorry. You were going to go ahead, Wiley. It's very interesting. Go ahead and finish your thought.
I already forgot what I was saying.
Oh, I'm so sorry. See, I hate when that happens. All right. I'll just go ahead. And the same thing, your strip non sequitur dances beautifully between like a strip format and some satire and political stuff. And you're very diverse. And we're the most diverse cartoonists we've ever had on the show, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't assume, I'm sorry I wasn't there with you when non sequitur started, so I don't know. I can't assume that the editors were allowing you to alternate your strip with political satire, children's stories, and Tales of Danae when you first syndicated. So what was Non Sequitur like when it started?
It was a single panel topical humor strip. The thing is, I remember when it first came out, and because it was single panel gag, it's like The Far Side. You look at The Far Side and think of this, and there's no
there are clearly no so cows in my strip.
It was always still had an editorial style. And editorial sensibilities about it had that edge to it. But was lighter, topical humor. This was actually my way of trying to show editors where topical humor belonged. Not on the editorial page, it belonged on the comics page. Well, sadly, as time has gone on, I'm now doing more editorializing on the in my comic strip than most editorial cartoons are on the editorial page. It's really sad. But if it started out, and this is what you do, especially in the beginning, that you kind of make it palatable. But I very intentionally made it, one more sophisticated humor. And I even chose the title Non Sequitur to appeal to editors. So what I was trying to do was to make a comic strip that editors would like. Again, I understood the business end of this is that the readers don't buy comic strips. Editors buy comic strips.
Yeah.
And then they are the worst possible judges of comics on the planet. And believe me, the average person on the street would make a far better comics editor than any editor in the newspapers today. But I had to know who we're selling to. And I just wanted to do more, more like New Yorker style cartoons.
Yeah.
For the paper. And so that's how it started out. That's what I intended to do. But I left this open-ended because when I set out to design the feature, one thing I realized, and again, having done this before and in knowing cartoonists and talking with them, that there is a burnout factor of for any comic strip.
Yeah.
For the traditional comic strip, it has an average lifespan, a creative lifespan of 5 years. After that, you've pretty much run the gamut of what you can do with these characters. There's ways to get around it, like what Charles Schulz did, is that he created new characters. Kept expanding on it. That's one way to do it. Because the traditional comic strip has, a central cast of characters in a certain place and in a certain time.
Yeah.
So you've already put boundaries around it right there. There's only so far you can go. And after about 5 years, 365 days a year, you pretty much run the gamut and you start pretty much repeating yourself after that, just finding more creative ways to repeat yourself. like it.
So are you saying Garfield has ran out of material, or you think he's still going strong?
Don't go on great.
They did introduce the spider character a couple of years back. That was interesting.
Yeah. So I wanted to have, even a feature like The Far Side was found within his style and what he was doing. And so, burnout was inevitable.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to create a feature that had really no boundaries on it, that would allow me to go off in any direction I wanted to once I felt the creative juices drying up. And so that's when I started getting in comic strip character type things early on. I actually started doing that in the first year. Just
I was going to say
sneaking in there. Yeah. And you just kind of work under the editor's radar. Again, having worked with editors for so long, I knew how to work around them.
You had to fool them.
They really are easy to fool. because you're dealing in a venue here that they really don't understand. I mean, the comics are so abstract to them. that they have a very difficult time wrapping their brains around it. So it's really easy that once you kind of rope them in, it, then you can start messing with their minds.
Well, you know, I'm looking through, I think it's your first collection, which is the very calmly titled Dead Lawyers and Other Pleasant Thoughts, which is, I like that one. But even in this one, I think this is the first collection, but you've got like Pierre of the North, who I think you should bring back, by the way.
Yeah,
Pierre
that
of the
was
North.
The first year, right? And that was sort of the first little character I started playing around with. And I
love Pierre. And I also... There's also a lot of like Sergio Aragonist sort of Mad Magazine little illustrations in between stuff, and you know it's great. I mean, already in your first book, you're all over the map, which is terrific.
Yeah, and you know that's that was very intentional on my part. It's you know planned chaos.
Yeah.
Do you think that because of your political cartooning background, you had a kind of an advantage because you have to do something different every day? Because I mean, Mike Peters of Mother Goose and Grimm does this too, where suddenly a joke has nothing to do with his characters. And I know he's a great political cartoonist too. So, do you think you have an advantage if you come from a political cartooning background and mix things up like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's very good experience just for getting the train of thought going and because the deadlines for doing an editorial cartoon for doing comic strip are completely different and equally deadly. That you know for the editorial cartoon you're doing a cartoon today that's going to appear tomorrow by and large. And you're working on immediate news and you know having to come up with an idea quick and to hone it and to you know make it coherent and then get it on paper and to print as quickly as possible. For a comic strip, it's an incessant deadline, and that's what's crunching about that no matter how much work you send in, you have to keep them.
It's the beast.
It's the same. That drives postal workers that bring an Uzi to work.
I have a question specifically oriented towards this. Now, there was a flap a couple of months ago about the KKK chicken who only lays egg whites, which I thought was brilliant. I very rarely laugh out loud on a comic, and that just killed me. But a couple of weeks later, there was another KKK one where the guy said, "I will work for your opponents, you know, your political opponent." Did you put that one in because of the flap on the KKK, or was that planned? Because it felt to me like you were saying,
yes to both.
Yes.
It worked for the gag, but it was also my little way of tweaking the nose of idiot Wisconsin, the editor who took non sequitur out for a couple of weeks because idiots were calling and writing to him who didn't understand the cartoon. This is what just drives us insane, us being cartoonists, about editors is how they pander to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
That idiots who call in who clearly didn't understand the cartoon and complain, and they listen to them instead of saying, "No, you're an idiot and you didn't get the cartoon." It's saying the polar opposite of what you're complaining about. So instead of educating them, they pander to them.
Yeah.
And say, "Oh, okay, let's keep them happy. Why?
Let's yank it." Yeah. Yeah.
What are they going to do? Drop the paper?
Yeah.
Guess what? You're the only game in town.
That's right. Man.
It was just stunning to me how people could take a cartoon that was clearly a knock on.
Yeah,
white supremacists.
Yeah,
and racism, and saying the cartoon was racist.
Yeah, as soon as they saw it.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
So I figured, it didn't occur to me that first cartoon, the egg whites cartoon, would raise any hackles because I thought if there was any group in the world left that was safe to take a shot at, it was white supremacists.
Plus, plus they're good sports, you know. They're real good sports over there, so, yeah.
Yeah. So I figured the only ones who'd complain about it would be white supremacists, and who cares if you get them upset.
That's not funny.
But I was just stunned how many emails I got from readers complaining about it, saying it was racist.
No, what's the next? What's the next?
Why would you bother reading comics if you don't get this?
Yeah, that was easy. Yeah.
What's the next step? Why are you making fun of Adolf Hitler? He's a good man. You know, geez, people, come on.
It was only misunderstood.
Actually, that second question I had originally was thinking of having the guy dressed as Adolf Hitler. But then I thought that would get people very confused.
Yeah.
Was this about Hitler or what? So, because this is the great thing about Klansmen. I mean, it's such an easily identifiable, you know, instantly identifiable image. And that's what we use in the comic, you know, metaphor and images, because you don't want people sitting there trying to figure it out. You want it to get across as quickly as possible. And it's pretty, so when you want a very abhorrent image, there's somebody that would repel everybody, you put a Klan outfit on.
Go.
I mean, it's easy. You know? So thank you, Klan, for giving this up.
Well, we got to stop right there just for a minute and take a break. This is one awesome interview, and I don't think we're going to let you listen to the rest of it until next week. What do you think, Justin?
Yes, I think that we should hold it ransom and be podcast pirates and make them pay money to hear the rest of it.
I'll put a PayPal link up. I got a pirate PayPal link up on the website, and you can pay for that. No, we do want to thank Wiley Miller tonight for his great, great insight. He is definitely a giant out there. I don't necessarily mean because of all the comics he publishes, but just he's such a great guy. Great guy.
Yeah, you know what? One thing I want to point out here halfway through the interview, you know, it feels like we're on PBS, you know? I mean, it's like we're holding the show ransom until we talk to you, and you go, oh, I wish these guys would shut up. But anyway, you know, he has the way he talks, he's very frank, and he cares about the business.
Yeah.
And he says things in no-nonsense terms, like, look, this is what you have to do. This is how you have to think. You have to think like an editor.
That's right.
I know editors. I've worked in papers. But now that you're hearing his voice, folks, you realize he's not this big, bad meanie. I hear that from a lot of people. They read his posts and they infer, but they do. They infer a certain thing about him from his language. And he's just as frank and direct and truthful.
Yeah. Anytime I've ever.
And passionate in his writing.
I agree. And anytime I've ever talked to him on any online forums, it's rare for him to just go straight out and attack you and go, rawr. It's more like his tactic is more to make you question your own statements. Are you sure you want to? Are you sure you want to say that? And so, I think that, you know, that's a good debater. So I think
I think it's just a really great interview. I think it might change people around in their thinking. Whatever people that you know might have negative thoughts about him. I never did, honestly. But if anybody has either from reading him, you know how you get a certain language in your head when you read things, and that may not be what the person typing meant to say. We've talked about this on the show several times about how people misconstrue meaning.
Yeah.
But now hopefully people will hear this and you know, since it's going to be a 2-hour show. and then after all that, they'll start to get used to his voice. And when they read him, they'll hear his voice and it may take some of the edge off that some people may feel. So I think that's valuable.
I think it is too. And I think that's one of the things that happened between, we talk about this later in the show, but I don't want to bring up too much because I don't think it's really worth talking about too much about. But with the little debacle between him and Scott Kurtz a couple years back, and I think that was one of the main problems is everybody was so defensive, and he was just really, I mean, in the way he really asked, the first couple of times I've seen what he said, it seemed more like Scott Kurtz should really question himself and what he's doing instead of, you know, that's kind of my take from a guy from the beginning of it. But, you know, whatever. Like I said, I'm not going to talk about it.
I wasn't around for that, and I can't really offer much because I don't really know anything about what they had between them or even I don't even know that much about Scott Kurtz and what he does, honestly.
Well, he says what he wants to say, too. He's another one of the guys. And I think that's one of the reasons why they probably bumped heads. You know, they're very straightforward, both of them. And I think that's probably more than any reason why they might have bumped heads a little bit. And I don't think they bumped heads as much as everybody made it out to. It's just kind of like, you know, like a fight out in the schoolyard. It was like, oh, ooh, did you hear him?
Oh, God.
So it actually got blown up a lot bigger than it really was. But
Well, maybe we can have Kurtz on the show sometime, and we can talk to him about it.
Yeah. Well, he'll never come on the show. He's a big jerk. Oh, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Right. Well, we have plenty of other people to interview.
That's right. I've talked to Kurtz on Extra Life Radio before, and he's a good guy, too.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah.
Good.
So he's not a
good,
bad
good,
guy.
Good.
None of these guys are bad. They're just passionate about what they do.
So. And what we found out is they all come at it from very different ways. I mean, just think of like 2 weeks ago, we had on Patrick McDonald.
Yeah.
And now we're talking to Wiley. And I mean, they're both wildly successful, but their approach is completely different.
Absolutely.
You know, other than their devotion to professionalism.
That's what it is.
You will find is universal across anybody who's successful. And I think that no matter who you are and how you want to do this thing, that is probably the one thing you're going to have to adopt if you're going to try to be professional.
I agree. 100%. But, hey.
You know what?
No, what? Go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, I was just thinking about, you know, I had an observation about comic strips.
Oh, yeah.
And something that, well, you know, we try to bring up topics and maybe give some people some ideas on how to construct their strips. And I was reading the Michaelis book this morning on Charles Schulz, reading it on the treadmill. And I'm actually getting to a part of this book where it's really starting to cook.
Yeah.
You know, it's in the early 50s, his strip got picked up. It's starting to the wheels are starting to turn. And it's funny, people don't really know how to take it at the time. You know, there wasn't a gag strip so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
People were reading it and going, oh, that last frame is just a boy going, sigh. How's that a punchline? How's that a gag line? They didn't know if this was going to work or if it was going to be wildly successful, but they knew they had something special.
Oh, yeah.
So it's getting into 1954. His wheels are really rolling, and, you know, he's really spreading things out. But there was one part in there he talked about ruining his strip because he was putting – sometimes he'd put a very interesting visual in the fourth frame. Now, this was – he was only doing four frames.
Yeah.
And people's eyes would go there, and it would give away the joke. So to fight that, he started making his first frames – very complex so that your eye would gravitate there first.
Huh.
It wouldn't ruin the gag.
Yeah.
And I've been, you know, I would do that sometimes in my strip. I would try to go do that too. And it's like, well, how can I make this last frame so kind of hide the punch of it, you know?
And
then I started doing the two on top, two on the bottom, and that wasn't really a factor anymore. But I did go through a time where I had that strip format.
Yeah.
And I started looking at Bloom County, more recently Opus. Now, this one last Sunday totally kind of ruins what I'm about to say. But the ones before, the older ones, like heck, even a few weeks ago, his last frames are so wild, and such a crash, you know, or the crucic, if you want to go back to the music notation, that I've trained myself that whenever I open up the page that has Opus, before I look at it, I will cover the lower right corner, honestly, with my hand, because I can't not look at it. It's always so cool looking.
Yeah.
And those big letters, someone screaming, right? So it just ends like a symphony or something that has a big crash of music at the end.
Yeah,
it's like that. I had to cover it up, and I read it, and then I unveil it. And that joke and the rhythm that was in Burke's brain when he thought of it and thought, hey, this is funny, comes through.
Interesting.
But if I read that last frame, it ruins it.
Yeah.
I know the punchline. I start to read it, and it doesn't work. So do you ever do that? Do you ever have to cover a last thing to avoid getting
ruined? I don't ever have to cover anything because I usually can force myself to not look.
Yeah,
I don't usually cover it, but that's an interesting concept. Maybe we should start selling punchline covers, and we can just, you know, a little popsicle stick with like a little a panel or something says "Don't read."
Well, we have to do something to raise money. Maybe panel covers might be the thing. We could patent panel covers.
Yeah, panel
perfect
blinders. Panel blinders for people not smart enough to not look at the end.
I can't help it.
If I try. Yeah.
I see, you know, I feel like I'm doing my eye strain.
Yeah.
I'm looking up, my head's up and I'm looking down and I can't resist it. Maybe I'm just a nut, that just, it ruins it for me. So anyway, but I started thinking, is that really a bad thing? Because think about it. What if that crash at the end is the thing that makes us want to keep reading it and keep looking forward to the next day? Whereas if everything, you know, is paced just right and it is a perfect little rhythmic thing, bang,
yeah, yeah,
like that.
Bum, bum, bum.
Maybe we're not anticipating. It's almost a rhythmic cliffhanger in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing. It certainly worked for him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's one of the most successful cartoonists there ever was.
I agree.
So I don't know, man. But
That's interesting.
As a creator, I would resist it.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't want it to pick it away, but I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing.
It'd probably be easier if it was if he still did, you know, the four panel black and whites, and then you could just fold the newspaper over to the back. But being a color, you can't do that. And sometimes the things he's been doing, you know, the way he's been formatting lately, sometimes it's hard to even know which panel to go to next before you accidentally goof up. So interesting stuff.
He's letting his mind go, and it's pretty cool. Go back and look at your Bloom counties and just go through and flip through the pages and see how many of those last frames are so wild and rhythmically noisy in a way.
I've studied his writings probably more than any other cartoonist that I've ever looked at.
Mm.
The books are just filled with notes and little sticky pads and stuff. I think he's amazing as far as that goes. Go ahead.
Today's Sunday. Ends very quietly and almost creepy and eerie.
Yeah.
So it kind of is an exception to the rule today.
Yeah.
But had I read that, it would have ruined it.
Yeah.
It would have ruined the joke. But I guess you could say that for anything.
Yeah.
But usually,
95%
of the time, he's ending on a big crash.
Yeah.
I just thought it was interesting that
I'm always having trouble going to the last panel of Garfield. I'm always sad about that.
Oh, the spider is squashed.
He's so squashed. I love the... We give Garfield such a hard time, but really it's one of the most successful comics in the world because it breaks all language barriers. I mean, you know, he has very little dialogue, and just about anybody in the world can appreciate it, so...
Oh, it has a value in itself. My little boy came up this morning. He said, "Read Garfield."
Yeah.
And he thought it was really funny.
That's, you know, so funny, Dad.
Yeah, he always brings it to me, wants me to read it.
Yeah.
His favorite strip is Get Fuzzy and Calvin and Hobbes.
I cannot imagine Get Fuzzy being it. Because, I mean, it is.
It's so weird.
It's so complex.
Loves it. Yeah. I have a book collection at home.
Yeah.
It's a few years old, and he reads it and just laughs. And he has, we used to read them together.
Yeah.
And I had a voice for Bucky and a different voice for Satchel. And then the guy was my regular one. So now he's taken those voices.
Yeah.
And he does the voices of the dog and cat. And I just do the guy.
Nice.
And we read them together. And, you know, I was thinking one time I might record a couple of those for a comic strip theater. And just
awesome. I would love that.
Okay. If I can find my stupid voice recorder that I've lost, I will do that because it might be kind of fun. He's only five, but he
reads. So your kid's into Cats with Attitudes then. Does he ever read Heathcliff?
I don't think we actually get that here at San Francisco Chronicle. I don't think we get that.
I know it's still out
there. Is
this
still going?
I guess so. It's got to be out there. I mean, I know because I've been on King Features not that long ago, and it was on there. And I'm just wondering which papers are carrying this, and, you know, who's writing it. And, you know, I'd just be interested to see that because I used to read Heathcliff when I was a kid, but before Garfield came along. And you know, that was the only Cat with Attitude back then that I knew of. So and so that was really interesting. And then I remember during the I think it was during the 80s they had like a cartoon too, didn't they? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, the Heathcliff cartoon, sure.
Yeah, wild stuff.
Think about Crazy Cat. The mouse was real mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And Crazy Cat was very gentle and sweet.
Yeah.
What if you did a strip today where the mouse is the victim? And, you know, because it's obvious, you know, you always want to turn that around. The underdog is always a tough, smart one, you know, and gets out of it.
Yeah.
But what if you had a strip where the little guy repeatedly got beaten?
Yeah.
And I think the way people are now, the way how mean people are, I think they would probably work.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be so funny. It's kind of like Ratbird in Dilbert. He kind of always gets the short end of the stick. But yeah, but to an extreme, even better. It would be even better.
I don't read Dilbert. I don't know.
Oh, you don't read Dilbert?
I can't read it.
You've eaten lunch with the man, and you can't even read his comic strip?
He's a lovely man. He's a very nice guy. He really is. I really like him as a person.
Yeah.
But I got to be honest on this show.
Yeah.
And I try to read that Sunday, and halfway through it, I'm thinking of something else. I can't hang in there. I don't know what it is. I just don't get it.
You just don't get it.
I don't.
It can't be.
Well,
for
I don't get. I don't get why I don't like it, or why I don't understand it.
Yeah.
I know it's a great strip.
Yeah.
And I you know, it's influenced many other strips that I like.
That's just the way it is,
I
man.
Just
you can, don't apologize don't for. Don't apologize
like
for.
It.
Yeah. Just don't apologize for that. There's strips that I don't get or don't like, and you know, other people like it. We've talked about that on the show before. And,
yeah.
I think it's, you know, it's a very valid thing. I'm sure Wally Miller hates some people too. And Stephen Pastis won't read and Stephen Pastis won't read anything but his own comic strip, and then he dies laughing, right?
Oh no, he reads everything.
Does he?
Yeah. We awesome. Talk about all kinds of different strips.
Yeah.
But we'll see in the second part of this interview, which you'll hear next week, ladies and gentlemen, just what comic strips Wally Miller might hate.
That's
Does
right.
Does he hate strips? We don't know. Stay tuned.
Hey, we do have a we've prattled on long enough.
Yes.
Let's do us a comic pick of the week.
All right. I have a time to do a comic pick of the week. This week, it's Kevin and Kel. Kevin and Kel, that's K-E-L-L. It's a very funny comic strip. By
Bill Holbrook.
Bill Holbrook, that's it. Bill Holbrook, who's a really nice guy.
Very nice guy.
And
I've actually met the guy at Dragon Con. A couple, two
yeah,
years
I
in
met
a row.
Him. I met him too. He's great. He's, oh, you've met him twice?
Yeah. I oh, win cool. two times.
Jeez, I
yeah.
feel like a tool.
You've only met him once because he came by the studio the day, right? At the Peanuts.
Yeah, he walked through my office.
Yeah.
It was really nice. Nice guy.
What's this guy doing?
But I guess the story of Kevin and Kel is basically they're a married couple, but they're animals. And what makes that special is that they're two people that would probably be very incompatible.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So you've got like the very epitome of an incompatible couple making a go of it as a married couple, and that's because Kevin is a rabbit and Kel is a wolf, and they met in an online chat room.
Yeah.
And, it's a great idea. And I wish him much success with this. Go to kevinandkel.com.
Yep.
It's Kel with two L's.
And you may remember him I believe it was the 80s and 90s. He used to do another comic strip syndicated on the Fast Track.
Yeah, which I think you could still look those up.
Yeah.
Was that with King Features?
I believe it was, I can't remember to tell you the truth. I'll have to look that up. Look at us being all unprepared. Yeah, it was King. I believe it was. Yeah, King Feature Syndicates.
Okay.
I believe so. On the Fast Track. We're looking it up, so you don't have to.
These guys are probably way ahead of all of us.
Yeah, I know. King Feature Syndicate on the Fast Track. That's definitely where it's at.
Okay.
Is it still being published? Apparently so, because there's a comic as recent as Friday, December the 7th, 2007. Now, you'll know King Features runs about a month and some behind, which I really appreciate about King Features. I think they have really increased the value of their comic as far as being published in the paper by doing that. And they still allow people to read a week at a time, so that's still good. So people can get their fill of what they're looking for. What do you think? You think that's a mistake?
Yeah.
You
think that they should. I think that they should only show creators' comics a month. I think they show them a month late online.
Yeah, but you don't like
all a month late, and the new stuff should be in the papers. That way, if you get people who are real fans, they'll buy the paper.
That's what they do. That's what King Features does.
Okay, yeah. There we go.
Then you agree with it?
Yeah, but I'm sorry. I guess I kind of missed out on what you were talking about because I just started thinking. This guy does a web comic and a syndicated comic, and I don't know if anybody else is doing that.
That's a good question.
Would you do that? If you were syndicated, would you sit there and go, hey, I want to do another thing?
I know it. Hey, I'm bored.
I think it's wildly creative, and I admire it.
Yeah.
But my God, I can't even put out five a week hardly.
Yeah. Yeah, I know it. That's what I say. Well, it does say that on the Fast Track has been distributed by King Feature Syndicate since 1984 and appears in 75 newspapers nationwide. So that's probably the reason why. He's probably trying to supplement some income. I mean, that's still a great amount of newspapers, but certainly no way to survive on that. So,
yeah, maybe he's getting another one ready. Maybe, you know, to try to take that one's place, maybe, you know, because he's certainly inside.
Yeah.
So he's got his contacts. And,
that's right.
So, yeah, maybe he's just wanted to switch up.
Yeah.
And maybe this is where he can refine it. That's a wonderful thing about web comics, isn't it?
Yeah. And I guess that's about it then.
Yeah. Let's we'll continue this marvelous interview next week.
All right, then. I guess we'll talk to you next week then, Justin.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
And we miss Tom.
Yeah, well, he'll be back.
Yeah, he'll be back. All right. Next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.